to speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Clear all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, April 30th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Activists gear up for May Day activities in honor of immigrant workers' rights. A new report on Burma and ongoing human rights violations linked to Chevron's pipeline, plus a close look at Bush's missile defense program. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A new report by Earth Rights International has found that state soldiers in Burma guarding a Chevron pipeline have killed nearby villagers while ordering others to serve as forced labor. Earth Rights accuses the Burmese military of murder and rape and draws its conclusions from interviews with villagers as well as Burmese refugees in Thailand. Chevron Corporation co-owns the Yadana pipeline with the French oil company Total and a Burmese company. The report calls on these companies to shut down the pipeline as a way to pressure the Burmese state into respecting democracy and human rights. Last year, Burma was in the spotlight because of a deadly crackdown on pro-democracy activists. And the ruling junta has kept democratically elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi in detention for years. The pipeline, co-owned by Chevron, is the single largest income source for the Burmese government. It was previously a project of Unocal Corporation, which was sued by local villagers over 10 years ago over the use of forced labor on the pipeline. Chevron then bought Unocal's stake in the pipeline, and Earth Rights International claims that the same abuses that occurred during the Unocal era continue today. My guest is Marco Simmons. He's the legal director of Earth Rights International. He joins us on the line this morning from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Uprising, Marco.
Thank you.
What happened with the lawsuit then that was filed against Unocal, and how was ERI, your organization, involved?
We were involved in representing the villagers who were victims of this pipeline project in their suit against Unocal. And we litigated that case on their behalf for 9 years until Unocal finally agreed to settle the case and to pay compensation to those victims. Now, a few weeks after the settlement of that case was announced, Chevron announced that it was buying Unocal. And it's important to note that although Unocal did compensate those victims and settle that case, that only accounts for a small handful of the total number of victims of this project, and that other victims still have the right to bring a suit against Chevron to remedy their injuries that they have suffered.
So, Mark, let's now focus on what has been happening more recently that your report covers. Give our listeners some details. Does the report cover a single incident, or is it ongoing abuses in the region surrounding the pipeline?
It's really ongoing abuses, and one of the reasons that we undertook this investigation was to see whether, after the settlement with Unocal and after Chevron acquired Unocal, whether these same kinds of abuses were continuing, because Chevron and Total have claimed that there is no more forced labor, for example, in the pipeline region.
And was there any action specifically that they took to justify this statement?
As far as I know, that statement is based on an organization, a Western organization that went into the pipeline region for about 5 days. And as far as I know, they had no experience documenting human rights abuses in Burma. They did not speak the local language. And so there's little chance that they would have gotten the true picture of what was going on there. We've interviewed over 70 refugees from the pipeline region and residents of the pipeline region. And everybody confirms that forced labor is still going on. It's an ongoing day-to-day fact of life for residents of the pipeline region. And today it even includes being forced to serve as sentries along the pipeline route itself. So the villagers are not only being conscripted to do the standard kinds of forced labor projects in Burma, such as road work and carrying munitions and food for patrolling soldiers, but they're actually forced to perform security duties on the pipeline project itself.
Now, when you say forced labor, specifically, what is the demographics of the villagers that are being forced into doing this labor, and are they compensated in any way?
They're typically not compensated.
So this is slavery.
It is slave labor. I mean, it's not lifetime slavery. The typical forced labor conscription might last one day, a few days, or in some cases, weeks or more. What happen is that a military unit would go into a village, tell the village leaders that they need so many people for a particular project. They would round up the people, and you know the forced labor is not limited to able-bodied, working-age men necessarily. In some cases, they conscript younger children or the elderly to do these projects as well. And they take them and essentially, at gunpoint, force them to do whatever it is that they need to do. And if people escape from the forced labor details, it can be a very serious problem for them that can lead to a response of deadly force from the military.
My guest is Marco Simmons, legal director of Earth Rights International. We're talking about the new report that was just released about ongoing human rights abuses in Burma linked to the pipeline that is co-owned by Chevron Corporation. Aside from forced labor, your report also documents torture, rape, and murder. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that? What are some incidents that have occurred, and how widespread are they?
Well, we document there's at least one killing that's very well documented that was confirmed to us by several different sources, of a man who was taken by the military, and apparently the military believed that he had some connection to insurgent or rebel groups operating in the area. And he was initially taken from a village that's maybe 20 miles from the pipeline, although it's a village that the pipeline security forces regularly conscript forced labor from because it's situated right next to a road that provides easy access. He was taken from this village by one of the dedicated pipeline security battalions, initially moved to another village that was about 10 miles closer to the pipeline, then moved to a village that's situated directly along the pipeline route and right next to the company's headquarters there. And then he was executed by the soldiers.
What was the motivation for this killing?
The motivation is apparently to either a case of mistaken identity that they thought he was supporting insurgents, or to send a message, whether they may not have even cared whether he really was supporting insurgent groups. They might have simply executed him to show the other villagers that they have the power to take anybody and execute them if anybody crosses them. Mm-hmm. And part of it is simply the way in which the Burmese soldiers are trained and conditioned. They are conditioned to devalue life and to commit brutal acts. They themselves are brutalized during their training program. And many of them are recruited as children. And so, as is the case with child soldiers in Africa, for example, their natural inclinations to respect human life are broken down through this brutalizing process. And so the Burmese military has become widely known for its brutality. They've also, this process also produces soldiers who are much more prone to sexual violence. Rape occurs everywhere, certainly, by all kinds of people, but in the Burmese military, it's especially rampant because of the training that these soldiers go through that dehumanizes the local population where they operate, especially women of ethnic minority groups. And also because rape most often goes completely unpunished in the Burmese army. So the case that, again, we confirmed through multiple sources in this case was of a very young girl, 6 or 7 years old, who was raped by a soldier from one of the pipeline security battalions. And again, as far as we can tell, that soldier was not punished for this. So these are the kinds of depredations that go on daily by Burmese soldiers, the soldiers that are there for the express purpose of protecting the oil company personnel and the oil company's project, this pipeline.
So how has Chevron responded, if at all, to this report?
So far, all that Chevron has said is that the allegations are baseless. Now, and I think it's worth noting that that's more than Chevron has said about human rights abuses in the pipeline region since they acquired Unocal 3 years ago. So they have remained totally silent up until this point about their role in this project until now. But as far as we can tell, Chevron has not done any serious investigation to try to determine whether there are, in fact, human rights abuses going on. And nobody has done any, you know, nobody from the oil companies has done any interviewing of the refugees who have fled the region to try to see what their experiences of life in the pipeline region were like.
So going back to the issue of the human rights abuses, Marco Simmons is my guest. He's the legal director of Earth Rights International. We're discussing Burma, ongoing human rights abuses, and Chevron's pipeline that it co-owns with a couple of other companies. So Chevron and the other oil companies have justified the existence of the pipeline project, saying that it improves the lives of those villages around them. Clearly, your report gives light to that. What sort of benefit, if any, does the pipeline bring to the surrounding areas?
Certainly, there are some people who have benefited from this program, but it's deficient in a number of ways. First of all, it doesn't extend to all of the villages that suffer under this military presence. Secondly, a lot of the projects that they tout, they exaggerate the benefits of these projects. They talk about the health care that they have provided to all the people in the pipeline region. But we have interviewed people, refugees, who specifically left their villages because they had medical conditions that they couldn't afford to pay for the treatment in the pipeline region, and so they sought free treatment in refugee camps along the border, which is not an easy decision to make. From what we can tell, the benefits, any benefits that the companies are providing are greatly exaggerated and certainly do not outweigh the serious burdens placed on the local population by this massive military presence in the pipeline region.
Now, Marco, isn't it true that there are U.S. sanctions on American companies operating in Burma? And if so, how is it that Chevron is continuing this project that coincidentally is the single largest source of income for the Burmese government, enabling the government to abuse its citizens?
It is the single largest source of income for the regime, and we estimate that it's currently providing around $1 billion of income annually to the Burmese military. In terms of how it is able to go forward despite the U.S. sanctions, the sanctions prohibit new investment in Burma. And when they were enacted, Unocal, Chevron's predecessor, was already involved in this project, and Unocal successfully lobbied for an exemption to the sanctions that would allow them to continue their ongoing project. And Chevron, because it purchased Unocal's stake, was able to come in under the same basically grandfathered provision. Because of the sanctions, Chevron is now essentially the only major U.S. company with operations in Burma now.
So it has a monopoly in a way.
It's the only game in town now. It's also essentially the only representative of the United States there. And in some ways, this can be seen as a problem not simply because of what Chevron's project is doing, but because of the image Chevron sends. Chevron has a red, white, and blue logo that's highly identifiable with the United States.
Finally, Marco, what do you recommend needs to be done now, and are there plans for Earth Rights International to represent some of these villagers who have suffered under the Burmese soldiers to sue Chevron, just like was done in the case of UNOCAL?
Well, in terms of a lawsuit, I would say that a case against Chevron would be every bit as strong as the case against UNOCAL was. Whether it will be filed or not depends in part on what Chevron does, whether Chevron responds to demands for compensation made by victims of the project, and whether those victims decide that they want to take that step going forward with a lawsuit. It's not necessarily an easy decision for them to make because it's a dangerous thing for them to do. You know, in the UNOCAL litigation, the identities of those victims, those plaintiffs, remained secret during the entire course of that litigation and are still confidential today.
Well, now, what about targeting Chevron's shareholders?
We do recommend that Chevron's shareholders closely examine a number of shareholders' resolutions that are up at the annual meeting this year and support those resolutions that call on Chevron to respect human rights, to respect the environment. And we expect that these resolutions will continue to be presented year after year. And we hope that the shareholders also put individualized pressure on Chevron's board of directors to make the corporation respect human rights and really, from an economic perspective, to limit its exposure to legal liability. And we hope that Chevron will provide compensation to those victims who have already suffered from this pipeline project.
Well, Marco Simmons, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And give out Earthrights website for our listeners.
We're at www.earthrights.org.
Earthrights.org is the website. Marco Simmons is the legal director of Earth Rights International. Thanks again, Marco, for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And you are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll speak with Victoria Sampson about the U.S.-Czech missile defense plans that have been delayed, and we'll also, after this short break and Radical Day in History, have a roundtable discussion about May Day activities tomorrow. Stay tuned.
People the time.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 30th in 1789, George Washington took the oath of office, becoming the first elected U.S. president. Washington was a celebrated hero of the Revolutionary War, and he constantly struggled to reconcile the ideals of the Revolution and the Constitution with the realities of slavery. As a Virginia plantation owner and a lifelong slave owner himself, Washington was certainly invested in the institution of slavery. While written documents show that he struggled with the morality of slavery, as a political figure, he never took the risk and voiced his abolitionist thinking. Instead, he signed a great deal of racist legislation into law. That's politics for you. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who says that? Who says that?
What is it?
So what do you call yourself, huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
Who are you?
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really want to know.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who?
Who?
Who is this?
Come out! Come out!
Seems as though I've heard that before.
Before we go to our next story, we'll go to this week's edition of Who Said That, a weekly contest in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives. Each week, we'll play you a short soundbite from the archives' vault and ask you to tell us who said that. All you have to do is call in and identify the voice, and we'll send you the CD from the Pacifica Radio Archives that featured the clip you just heard. Let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
Y como nosotros somos chicanos, there can never be any difference. The whole line that they've given us, that our best interests lie with the Democratic Party, is a lie. It's a lie. It's a hypocrisy. It's just another atole con el dedo movida.
And if you know who that is, and if you haven't won yet, call us right now at 818-985-5735 with your best guess. That's 818-985-KPFK. Tomorrow is May Day, and workers around the world and here in the United States are marking the Workers' Rights Day with rallies, protests, and marches. In Thailand, labor leaders are threatening a mass protest over the minimum wage. 50,000 people are expected to march in Moscow at a rally organized by the Communist Party, criticizing President-elect Dmitry Medvedev. Turkish trade unions are planning a rally at Istanbul's Taksim Square, an area where such gatherings have been banned for over 30 years. And 50,000 Cuban youth are expected to participate in a mass march through Havana's Revolution Square. In the past 3 years in the United States, May Day has been commemorated as a day in honor of immigrant workers within the context of ongoing anti-immigrant attacks and the national debate on immigration reform. This year, in the state of California, dock workers of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union have decided to stop work for 8 hours in all U.S. West Coast ports on May Day to call for an end to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Locally, the majority of immigrants' rights groups are organizing two major rallies that will join together in downtown Los Angeles. One of the marches originates in MacArthur Park, the site of last year's police crackdown on demonstrators and their families. Joining me in studio this morning are three organizers. Garrick Ruiz is a core volunteer with Garment Workers Center. Welcome to Uprising, Garrick.
Thanks for having us.
And also Shuming Cheer is a civil rights coordinator at the South Asian Network. Welcome, Shuming.
Good morning.
And with us is Taina Reyes. She is the director of the Santa Ana office with Hermandad Mexicana Latino America. Welcome to Uprising, Taina.
Good morning, Sonali. Welcome.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about the way in which May Day in this country, which of course is an important day historically in the United States, it has its origins in the U.S., kind of had fallen by the wayside in terms of a day for workers, has now been resurrected, particularly around immigrant workers. Can you talk a little bit about why May Day is so important for immigrants and recognizing the work and the contributions of immigrants? Garrick?
Well, I think, as you said, one way that May Day has been known is International Workers' Day. And we at the Garment Workers Center feel it's really important to talk about that history, about how it came about in the U.S. as a day celebrating all workers, and immigrant workers are clearly a big part of that today, particularly in Los Angeles, and celebrating, you know, workers' rights, people's human rights to migrate, to immigrate where they need to, and really counteracting, like you said, a lot of this anti-immigrant hysteria that's recurred over and over again in the history of this country, but in particular we're seeing another upsurge in the last few years.
And it seems as though the presidential election has raised that demon again, if you will. Everyone wants a scapegoat, and immigrants are quite convenient because they're vulnerable. So on this May Day, it seems particularly significant that immigrants will be coming out in mass numbers. Shuming or Taina, would you like to comment on that?
Sure. I mean, I agree that currently with the presidential debate, it's really shifting the dialogue towards the right wing and really towards the anti-immigrant sentiment. And also wanted to point out, in terms of looking at the history of May Day, that it's important to remember the power of worker organizing and also the ways in which the state has tried to suppress worker organizing. For example, when May Day originated, many people were killed by the police. And this is, of course, very similar to what happened last year with the police brutality in MacArthur Park.
Not that people were killed, but of course they were extremely brutalized.
Right, exactly. And the ways in which when people try to organize, that the state does try to suppress that. And so for South Asian Network, we want one of our themes to be looking at state repression and basically fighting back against both immigration and police repression of our communities.
And state repression, of course, has come most dramatically in the form of the ICE raids, an issue that has really put fear into immigrant communities. And Taina, what are your thoughts on this sort of May Day as a day to celebrate immigrants?
Well, today's May Day is a continuity of the original May Day struggle of the 1880s led by immigrant workers of European national origin for the eight-hour day. And that was the main demand of the day back then. Immigrants were the worst compensated and the worst jobs and the least organized into unions. And they led the struggle for these changes, and similar circumstances apply today. We don't discount the advances that have been made in the labor movement, but also we recognize that immigrant workers compose a growing share of the workforce of many industries, and they're leading the struggle to improve conditions of work and wages in these industries and the fight for fair and humane immigration reform.
Hmm. And before we move on with our conversation, let me announce the major events happening tomorrow within the Los Angeles area. There are going to be two separate marches that then converge together. The event organized by MeWan, which is the multi-immigrant help me out with that.
Multi-ethnic Immigrant Workers Organizing Network.
Thank you. That starts at MacArthur Park at 2 p.m. And then the March 25th Coalition has its march beginning at 2 p.m. at Olympic and Broadway. The two of them will unite at 5th and Broadway. And then in Orange County, there's going to be an event, rally and march, at the Plaza de las Banderas at 10 Civic Center Plaza in Santa Ana between Broadway and Flower from 11 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. The march is at 3:30 p.m. and people are being asked to wear white and bring banners. And we'll repeat that information later. So first, let's discuss last year's events that you brought up, Shuming, which was this incredible repression that nobody expected. Mayor Villaraigosa had to return from a tour that he was conducting abroad to deal with the uproar from the community over police brutality. Do you expect anything of that sort this year? And has last year's debacle been resolved in any way?
Well, we don't expect anything in terms of that level of police violence, but we are very troubled from the reports we've read where the LA Police Department has been stating that they plan to go into the protest and extract people who they perceive as quote-unquote troublemakers. And so we see that as being very divisive because we believe that everybody who's attending the protest is there to support workers' rights and immigrant rights, and that we shouldn't be singling out certain people who might look like a certain way or support any of these police efforts to really divide our communities.
I think it's really important to remember that May Day in the 1880s did start with a police attack on a peaceful rally, and that historically police have been used over and over again against workers. And over the last week, we've really seen the LAPD ramp up this kind of rhetoric of good protester versus bad protester that they've done over and over again in various protest situations. And it's really important, I think, for listeners to remember that we are all out there together to support immigrants' rights, to support workers' rights, and really build unity and build support for justice in the workplace.
How do they tell apart a good protester from a bad protester, whatever those labels mean?
I mean, I think often based on stereotypes of what they think an quote-unquote anarchist might look like. We've heard comments about people with bandanas are perceived to be dangerous or inciting violence. So I think a lot of that is very similar to the type of racial profiling that often leads to police violence in the first place.
Hmm. So what is the significance also of the two major sort of coalitions in the Southern California area coming together? Last year, there were two separate events on the same day. This year, they're sort of separate, but then they're also together. What were the discussions that went around organizing it in this manner?
Yeah, I mean, in Orange County, we've just basically decided to get all the organizations together and march together in one march. It's a small area, but that's the way we need to work in getting together and on all a common goal of immigration reform and, you know, stop any injustice that are going on in the workplace and come together as a common goal, and so we can therefore obtain some type of immigration reform.
Sure. So that's in Orange County, but what about the two marches here in Los Angeles? What's the significance of them coming together and having one march together? Does that signify a new sense of unity in the community?
Yes, well, that was the intention, to have these two marches happen on the same time and to meet up to show that the immigrant rights movement is becoming more unified, that our main goals, again, of legalization, of stopping the raids, of peace and dignity, are true for all the groups that are working on immigrant rights.
And where do you see this? I mean, May Day is one day where people will come out and they're celebrating immigrant workers' rights and making the demands that you just mentioned, Shuming. But what about the larger struggle? Let's talk a little bit about what are some of the main goals in this election year of your various organizations. Garrick, would you like to start?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that some of the earlier discussion made me think about is how May Day started with this demand for an 8-hour workday. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to, you know, I think a lot of listeners probably assume that people have an 8-hour workday today. And one of the things is that that's just not true. You know, I can say specifically in the garment industry, amongst immigrant workers, people do not have an 8-hour workday. They're working 10, 12 hours, much like they were in the 1880s. And so our way of combating that is really focusing on worker organizing, on workers building organization, on being able to stand up for their rights in the workplace. And that's really what we've been focused on for the last several years and will continue to be focused on.
So does that include unionizing efforts?
I mean,
or is that just, you know, at this point,
unfortunately,
even unrealistic?
Unfortunately, right now, there are no unions that are organizing garment workers. And so that's the Garment Workers Center came about as a worker center short of a union. Certainly, we see great importance in workers' organizations, mm-hmm. and our, you know, in our education and talking through with workers, that's the kind of stuff they're talking about. But there are no unions right now, unfortunately.
And how have the ICE raids impacted garment workers, if at all? And also, what are, you know, some of the things that workers can do, as you know, to protect themselves and to feel secure?
I think the threat of ICE raids is, again, a way that to increase the kind of fear and terror amongst workers, and to keep them in line, basically. We've seen employers threaten to call ICE on workers. We've seen ICE used in various places against workers that are organizing, not necessarily in the garment industry in particular, but clearly they've been raiding all kinds of places. And so I think it's really a part of this general atmosphere of fear, to keep people in line and not stand up for their rights.
So what does the Garment Workers Center offer the workers specifically?
We have been doing a lot of education, training people in their rights, in particular to that people have the right not to answer questions from police or ICE agents. People have the right to remain silent, and that's really important if you're caught up in a raid. And then we educate people on their rights under California labor law, and which does not depend on your immigration status. California labor law is about workers. It's not about whether you're a resident, a citizen, or not a citizen.
Will garment workers be able to come out for the marches tomorrow at 2 p.m.?
Oh, there will definitely be a garment worker contingent, and we invite people to come down actually and join us at 1 p.m. At the Garment Workers Center at 1250 South Los Angeles Street, where we'll be gathering and then going up to join the march at Olympic and Broadway.
Taina Reyes, let's talk a little bit about the work of Hermandad Mexicana Latinoamericana. You're the director of the Santa Ana office, involved personally in the Orange County March, but your organization is also involved in the Los Angeles area events. What are the main goals in immigration issues that your organization is working on currently? What are your short-term versus long-term strategies?
The greatest emphasis in the work of Hermandad Mexicana Latinoamericana today is creating base organization amongst immigrant workers, which takes time and resources.
What do you mean by base organizations?
Like all of our organizations in our area, creating grassroots organizing efforts to educate our community. We're looking forward to higher voter participation this year and working on that for the June and November elections. And we're preparing ourselves for an all-out political and legislative fight for immigration reform in the year of 2009. Our work includes educating our community about their rights, how to fight for their rights, and how to confront state terror at all levels, raids, deportations, problems in the workplace. And we're preparing ourselves to organize our members in the workplace for the first time, not just in the community.
Mm-hmm. And Shuming Chir, let's talk about the South Asian Network. The South Asian community in Artesia is also organizing a 9:30 a.m. march, a separate forum, but in addition to the afternoon marches?
That's correct. So we'll be at the 2 p.m. afternoon march starting from MacArthur Park, but this is the first time that we'll be having a workers' march in Artesia, and we've been working with the workers there who've come to us with a lot of issues about lack of overtime pay, working more than 8 hours, lack of benefits also. So it was their idea to have a procession along Pioneer Boulevard in Artesia to really show that workers' rights do exist, they should be respected. And so we ask all allies to join us. We'll be meeting at 9:30 at the South Asian Network office, which is 18173 South Pioneer Boulevard in Artesia, and the march will start at 10 a.m.
So what are the long-term and short-term goals of South Asian Network and how it fits within the larger immigrant rights movement?
Well, in terms of short-term goals, we are living right now currently in a very repressive moment where national security is sort of the dominant rhetoric, and that has been applied very negatively towards South Asian and Muslim communities. So some of our short-term goals are to fight back against these attacks by doing public education, by working with the community to really speak out and assert their rights. And in terms of our long-term goal, we are looking at abolishing the entire prison and deportation regime. I mean, that's, of course, very long-term. And in the meantime, we're looking at building community solutions so that we find ways to address the violence in our communities, to address the injustices without having to turn to the state and without having to rely on prisons.
I want to pose a question to all three of you. I mean, you three are representative of a small portion of the vast number of organizations working in various ways on immigrant rights in Southern California as a whole. How effective do you think the movements have been over the last 3 years, which have gained a lot of visibility? Is there a sense that maybe the groups are a little fractured or working separately, or is there a sense of unity that is symbolized by tomorrow's march together, that groups are really coming together on a more unified agenda, having sort of one unified agenda and then their own separate local and short-term agendas? What are your thoughts on that sort of strategizing within the movement?
I could say here in from Hermandad Mexicana, we do see that different organizations are a little fractured, but we continue all to work together and to go out and reach out to different unions, churches, business, and continue to say what our goals are and how we can work together to obtain these goals.
Derek, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think, as you said, I think that this march tomorrow, or the marches tomorrow coming together, is symbolic of people coming together around, you know, a general framework of immigrants' rights. I mean, I think the different groups have different perspectives, certainly, but I think one thing is that we all have some core issues that we all believe in, that we all are working towards.
And can you mention some of those? I mean, Shuming mentioned a few, but what are sort of the main demands tomorrow?
I mean, I think, you know, certainly for us, the big thing is around immigrants' rights and workers' rights, and that
legislatively.
Like I said, our focus is not really legislative. Mm-hmm. Our focus is on worker organizing and building ties between workers, between immigrant workers in different sectors, in different workplaces around the city of Los Angeles, and really internationally, as symbolized by this day, International Workers' Day. And so that's really our focus, is building unity amongst the folks who this day represents, in order to build strategies to really, in the workplace, stand up and demand rights, demand more justice in the workplace.
Shuming Chu, your thoughts on and also your idea of what the goals are tomorrow for the groups coming together as a whole?
I think one of the goals is to show that the ICE raids have affected all of our communities in different ways, and that we want to have a unified response to oppose these raids. And one core value that I think all the organizations share is the value of human rights, to basically look at the fact that our communities deserve good jobs, deserve medical care, deserve safe, affordable housing. And these are things that we should all strive for, and that these are things that we all deserve. And not only for people here in the U.S., but also looking at our communities who are abroad and looking at how to make the lives of people abroad better so that they're not forced to migrate to the U.S.
Hmm. And let me also give all three of you an opportunity to give our listeners information about how they can get a hold of you if they want to get involved, if there are any other upcoming events, websites, phone numbers that you would like to give out, starting with you, Taina.
You can reach our office at 714-541-0250, and the toll-free number is 1-888-465-6005 or www.hermandadmexicana.org.
And we will put that on our website later today, Gary Cruz.
Again, come down and join the garment worker contingent at 1 p.m. tomorrow at 1250 South Los Angeles Street near PICO. The workers are asking people to wear white for our contingent. Our number, if you have any questions, is 213-748-5866. And our website is garmentworkercenter.org. No S on the end of worker.
And Shuming Chia with South Asian Network.
So we invite everybody to join us at 9:30 at the South Asian Network office, and our phone number is 562-403-0488, and our website is southasiannetwork.org.
And let me try to repeat all of this information as I jotted down real fast. Again, for Hermandad Mexicana, their office number is 714-541-0250. Toll-free is 1-888-465-6005. Their website is hermandadmexicana.org. Garment Worker Center is having a pre-march event at 1 p.m. in front of their office, 1250 South Los Angeles Street. They're asking you to wear white, and then they'll be joining in with a larger march at 2 p.m. Their website is garmentworkercenter.org, and the number is 213-748-5866. South Asian Network is having their morning march at 9:30 a.m. And where is that happening again? On Pioneer Boulevard?
Yes, it's going to be along Pioneer Boulevard, and people can meet at our office, which is 18173 South Pioneer Boulevard.
And that's 18173 South Pioneer Boulevard. Number is 562-403-0488. Website is southasiannetwork.org. And if you missed all of that, we'll put it on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Again, the main march in Los Angeles tomorrow will be two marches uniting at 5th and Broadway in downtown L.A. One march starts at 2 p.m. at MacArthur Park. Another starts at 2 p.m. at Olympic and Broadway. You are listening to Uprising. And I want to thank the three of you very much for joining us today, Garrick Ruiz, Shuming Chir, and Taina Reyes.
Thank you for having us.
And we will be right back after this short break with the winner of this week's Who Said That, plus our last story on the U.S. Czech missile defense plans that have been delayed. Stay tuned.
May 1st, International Workers' Day, there will be two marches and rallies here in Los Angeles. Stop the Raids, Legalization for All, and Dignity and Peace for All Workers. MeWan's march starts at MacArthur Park at 2 p.m. The March 25th Coalition's march starts at Olympic and Broadway in downtown, also at 2 p.m. The marches will unite at 5th and Broadway for a program and rally at Pershing Square. KPFK will be there live, broadcasting from 4 to 6 p.m. That's May 1st, KPFK's live broadcast from the International Workers' Day marches and rallies from 4 to 6 p.m. here on Radio Powered by the People.
Welcome back to Uprising. Before we go to our last story of the day, the winner of this week's Who Said That contest is Lionel Heredia. Welcome to Uprising. Congratulations, Lionel. And the correct answer is Jose Angel Gutierrez. That's the voice that you heard earlier. A little bit of background. Jose Angel Gutierrez is an attorney and professor at the University of Texas at Arlington. He was a founding member of the Mexican-American Youth Organization in San Antonio in 1967 and founding member and past president of the Raza Unida Party. He has written many books, including A Gringo Manual on How to Handle Mexicans and The Making of a Chicano Militant. In 2006, he debated David Horowitz on the Sean Hannity Show. So we will send a copy of the CD that we played a track from to Lionel. And let's take another listen to that clip.
Y como nosotros somos chicanos, there can never be any difference. The whole line that they've given us, that our best interests lie with the Democratic Party, is a lie. It's a lie. It's a hypocrisy. It's just another atole con el dedo movida.
That's Jose Angel Gutierrez, and that's from a speech that he gave in 1972 on October 10th at the University of New Mexico. He was one of the leaders of the first Chicano movement for political power. We will send our winner a copy of the CD. For those of you who didn't win, you can order this excellent CD from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And tune in next week for our weekly contest again. Dozens of Greenpeace activists occupied a military site south of Prague on Monday, where the United States has plans to construct a missile defense radar base. News of the action came as the U.S. State Department informed the Czech Republic that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice would have to delay signing a missile defense treaty between the two nations. Rice claimed scheduling conflicts is the reason for her unavailability in Prague in early May to finalize the controversial plans, which are opposed by 70% of Czechs. The U.S.'s declared rationale for the proposed Czech base is to protect the region from possible attacks from the Middle East. Russia, wary of the proposed base's proximity to its borders, has criticized the plans on the grounds that it could trigger a new arms race. Meanwhile, the House Subcommittee on National Security and Foreign Affairs is hearing testimonies today on the program, as $12.3 billion has been requested in anti-ballistic missile defense spending. Critics say that the program's burden to taxpayers is not in tune with the actual threat faced. My guest this morning is Victoria Sampson. She's a research analyst with the Center for Defense Information. Welcome to Uprising, Victoria.
Thank you for having me.
So first, let's talk about the actual threat faced. On what basis is this money being requested?
Well, there actually aren't too many countries that actually have missiles that can reach the United States these days. Really, the only ones who have them are Russia, China, the United Kingdom, and France. And none of those countries are likely to hit us with ICBMs anytime soon. What's been used as justification for the missile defense system is North Korea, which doesn't have an ICBM, and Iran, which doesn't have anything close to an ICBM. So really, we're putting a lot of money. We're pumping, by the 2013, we'll have spent nearly $200 billion into meeting a non-existent threat.
And this at a time when the economy is going into a recession, when times are very tough for people, and our tax money is being spent on something that sounds like it just is not warranted.
Absolutely. I mean, even with the Defense Department having a budget of roughly $500 billion, choices must be made. There's always something we need to be looking at, and we need to focus our money on the biggest threat to us. For example, Condoleezza Rice was scheduled to give a speech on September 11th, 2001, to talk about the biggest threat facing the United States. She wasn't planning on talking about terrorism. She was planning on talking about missile defense. We're really keeping our eyes on the wrong ball here.
What is the motivation of the Bush administration, you think, regarding missile defense? What's their real agenda?
Well, it's become a Ronald Reagan legacy. You know, the initial Star Wars speech was given in 1983 by Ronald Reagan. It's become almost a plank of the Republican Party. But I think a lot of what their emphasis on getting missile defense out and, you know, troubling the spending on missile defense from Clinton to Bush 43 is that they're trying to create some sort of institutional momentum so the missile defense continues long after Bush leaves office.
And is the technology even viable?
Nothing's against the laws of physics, but when you look at the test record, for example, what we're looking at deploying in Europe, the radar in the Czech Republic and interceptors, 10 interceptors in Poland, it's based on what's already been deployed in Alaska and California. This system has undergone testing over the past 10 years. Out of 13 very heavily scripted attempts, they made intercepts 7 times. So they have a pretty middling test record. They have not fully proven that they can work in a realistic and operational circumstance.
Hmm. So what's happening in the Czech Republic? I mentioned that activists have occupied the military site where the U.S. has plans to construct the base, and 70% of Czechs are opposed to it, but the Czech government seems to be happy to work with the U.S.
The Czech government is absolutely delighted at the option of collaborating with the United States on this. But, as you said, they have to deal with a small issue of the majority of the population not wanting to do it. They've got a missile defense czar created, a man whose only job is to generate interest in missile defense within the Czech public. Obviously, he has his work cut out for him. But one of the real concerns, I think, is that, A, the Czech Republic will become a target just in and of itself because they're hosting the radar, and, B, what happens with Russia? For example, Russia is very upset about the idea of having U.S. missile defenses so close to its territory. And one of the ways in which it said, well, we might be okay with it, is by putting Russian military observers on Czech and Polish soil. The Czech Republic and Poland have already had that experience, and they're not very excited about the opportunity of having more military officials from Russia there. So it's something that they still need to pound out the details, if and when they can actually do it. The question is, what's going to happen next year when the Bush administration leaves office? They don't want to be left holding the bag if the next administration decides not to do it, and they've already upset a very powerful neighbor.
Hmm. And does Russia actually have any plans to have any sort of counter to this base in the Czech Republic, which is so close to its borders?
Well, Russia offered last year, in lieu of the Czech Republic radar and the Polish interceptors, they said, well, you can use the early warning radar in our territory. We've got one in Azerbaijan, which would be very well placed to see if there are any missiles coming from Iran. The United States is kind of hemmed and hawed about it. Our idea is always, well, we'd be happy to use that together with our other suggested missile defense systems in Poland, Czech Republic, and Russia says, no, our offer is just for Azerbaijan instead of. So it's kind of a point that we've been stuck on during negotiations.
Why do you think Condoleezza Rice delayed signing this treaty? Does it have anything to do with, you think, the opposition in the Czech Republic?
I think there's definitely something to be led to it. They've been talking about signing it over the past couple months. Initially, it was going to be signed at the NATO summit in early April, and then it was supposed to be signed at a big meeting May 5th, and now that's been pushed back possibly until June. And I know a lot of countries who are looking at working out deals in the United States are very worried about getting everything settled before Congress goes to recess this summer, because once that happens and you get back and then there's a hardcore part of the election, and at that point you're pretty much stuck. You can't do anything until January of next year.
So let's talk about the House Subcommittee on National Security and Foreign Affairs. They're hearing testimonies today on the program and are considering this request from the White House for $12.3 billion. I understand that some of your colleagues are going to be testifying.
Yes, my colleague Phil Coyle, who is the chief weapons tester for the Pentagon for 7 years and worked at the Department of Energy for 30 years before that, is one of the people testifying, and he's going to be discussing the technical limitations that they've had for the missile defense program.
And what do you think the sentiment is in Congress to approve this program?
Congress traditionally has been fairly receptive to the idea of missile defense just because they don't want to be seen as being soft on defense. But more recently, they've been taking over more of their oversight responsibilities. Missile defense has been relieved of all the reporting requirements that most Pentagon weapon systems have. It doesn't have to decide how much money things are going to cost. It doesn't have to give a timeline. It doesn't have to have milestones. Basically, it's free to develop as it chooses, which really means you're going to get a bloated program. So Congress is starting to look into reining back missile defense a bit, and I think with these oversight hearings we're having, we're finally getting to see some of that.
What do you recommend, finally, that listeners do if they're upset about all of their taxpayers' money possibly being spent on this program?
Well, the biggest thing is to write your representative. They do listen to constituents, and they do keep this as a concern. I mean, one of the main reasons why we've had this continued for so long is that there are a lot of jobs related in a lot of different districts for Congress because of this. So they're always looking at saying, well, how is it going to affect my people? So if people can write in, write letters to the editor, educate yourselves about the problems of missile defense, I think that we can have a more realistic dialogue about what we can hope to achieve.
And where can listeners find out more information?
Why, you can go to the Center for Defense Information's website at www.cdi.org.
That's cdi.org. That's the Center for Defense Information. My guest has been Victoria Sampson, research analyst there. Victoria, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
Victoria Sampson, again, research analyst at the Center for Defense Information. cdi.org is the website that you can find out more. And we have been discussing earlier in the hour May Day events, and we'll list all of that on our website, by the way. There's also going to be an event at MacArthur Park from 4 to 10:30 p.m. for a peaceful gathering. There'll be food and film screening. And so all of those events will be listed on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Force Anali Subversive Thought Fedre, Fidel Castro once said, "The ever more sophisticated weapons piling up in the arsenals of the wealthiest and the mightiest can kill the illiterate, the ill, the poor, and the hungry, but they cannot kill ignorance, illness, poverty, or hunger." That's Fidel Castro, and that's Sonali Subversive Thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, uprisingradio.org. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.